Next case, 97-2641, Cincinnati Bar Association versus Mark Fidley.
When he was no longer a young lawyer, that he apparently lied to the investigator when he was asked if he'd ever taken anything, never been in trouble before, and he said no. Expungement, even if he believed there was an expungement, that wouldn't affect that misstatement, would it?
Well, again, we go back to the factual finding, the way that they stated, I don't know if I can find it specifically, but the report for admit. Because when they came, see, at that point, he believed the expungement had occurred. He checked in the meantime, and then when they came to the court reporter, and you'll notice in the transcript and the bar's timely appended that to its brief, the first mention of that 1985 incident didn't come in the form of a question or an accusation. It was, yes, he told them. Once he had determined the expungement did not occur. He was under the belief that if it is expunged, perhaps this is correct, but we're going to willfulness and an attitude on the part of the board maybe a draconian attitude with respect.
How could he think the expungement had been entered when the person who caught him shoplifting checked and they asked him if he'd done this before and he said no. They checked and found that there'd been no expungement, that also, indeed there had been a prior.
And I speak from personal experience, sometimes you can get a court order expunging something and it doesn't find its way to the computer unless the lawyer parses, writes letters and threatens to sue. Sometimes it gets done, sometimes it doesn't.
What was his reason? I wasn't clear. Was he told by a lawyer? It wasn't you that represented him on the expungement, I assume. Right, so I mean, was he told by a lawyer that there was an expungement, that there was going to be, that, I mean, I don't understand
sure
why he wouldn't know that there, whether he had a crime expunged or not.
Okay, I don't want to go outside the record here.
Okay.
I know the answer to that, but I don't think it's on the record.
Okay.
If you want me, I'll
No, that's fair. No, I don't want to hear.
Because that was the first point I'm sort of harping on here. We have to stick with this record. So we're holding that it's not a willful failure to file in 1985 incident, but the board also made a finding that's totally unsupported by the record, and that's that Mr. Pittler reported the latest incident only after an early pause the prosecutor threatened to report it. Now we had a little dying brook in the hearing when the matter was brought up because prior to that, this was mentioned in the hearing, letters were furnished to Relator's counsel from both Mr. Fiddler's lawyer in the criminal case and the prosecutor that before the matter came up, he came to each of them and one of them said, I'm going to report this. And the prosecutor then said, well, I'm glad to hear that because if you did not, would you have to? And let me see what the hearing of our counsel said. And we just wanted to make the record clear that the prosecutor didn't make that statement, and I agreed to it. They did make the statement. But that doesn't change the fact that Mr. Fizzer had made the decision beforehand, and that's all the record reflects. And the board's finding the contrary is unsupported by the record. I think what they're doing is they said, well, we don't believe him on this point, therefore we believe the opposite. We can't do that. Especially when the witness is the one that does not give a word of proof. You can't elevate the disbelief of a denial into proof that the opposite occurred. And I think that's what the board tried to do here, although they didn't say they made any credibility finding. Although I think necessarily problems. Again, they talked about, see, it took him 3 months to report this. But his testimony is very compelling, and he was in agony for those 3 months, and still is, up to the hearing. He wrote dozens of letters, and unsatisfactory, and the last letter that he wrote took a week. Just to get it the way he wanted and to get it out. Again, should a lawyer report a conviction? I say morally and ethically, probably so. Does the code require it? I say no. We have due process concerns here. You do have to report if you are disciplined in another jurisdiction. But again, we're talking an ex post facto judicial violation. If the court would decide now, in light of the language and the rules, that that's absolutely required. Although, again, as a lawyer, I would say certainly you should do that. Mr. Fiddler knows that, and he reported, he didn't run to the rules. That's his right to report this, and he did it. The bar states that there's really not essentially any mitigation. Our brief sets out, I think, 11 separate categories of solid mitigation. The bar says, this really bothers me, that he is asking for quote, preferential treatment, unquote, because he sought help. And that's what he's supposed to do. I think this court
may have been a poor choice of words. To deal with the fact that we do get people to treat the disease.
I know, that's
probably a poor choice
of words. I think, again, it's a unduly punitive attitude in this case by Relator. Mr. Rothwell, again, we number one, he did everything I think that a person can and should do once this act occurred. He went to therapy. He's still going to therapy. He learned that the fact that triggered this incident is exactly the same type of emotional situation that he faced back in 1985 when he was much less mature, and it triggered the same response.
Is it significant, Mr. Hafer, that the relator, as you know, responds to that mitigation argument that to summarize it, it seems as if he's gotten his counseling, maybe not begrudgingly, but because he's been sort of urged to by the steps in the discipline process. He took a one-day course, and then he didn't really get into apparently serious counseling until he was urged to, apparently, by the relators, until the claim was about ready to file.
Well, with respect to the, I should say that it's going to what they call the theft school. And of course, it was done before I was involved. It was there for voluntary as far as. And again, if the disciplinary process triggers beneficial treatment and a realization by the lawyer that he should do something, and then he follows through, as Mr. Fielder, he hasn't done necessarily a bad thing. I personally believe he wants the psychologist on his own.
Well, he should want the counseling for himself, rather,
sure,
regardless of what we say, I would think.
That's why he went.
He has a problem, obviously.
Because of the same situation arises again if he doesn't deal with his problem. And apparently it only comes up when impending parenthood is an issue. And I think at this point, with the additional maturity, he's not about to get help and do something. Now, the fact that, and again, with the grievance process, he initiated. He's the one that initiated. So I think he realized at that point, obviously, that there's a problem. But again, it has taken him time to do things. It took him time and some time to write the letter, to get the letter right, and going through agony for, I think it was almost 3 months. The last letter took a week to write. This is how people are. This is how we're just lawyers like everybody else. And the bar comes in here. I mean, not everybody deserves to be hammered when they do something wrong. And here, and the court's seen many cases where lawyers don't get help. Now, he didn't get help back in 1985, bar claims, so that's true. He was immature at that time, didn't realize what the triggering factor was. It came up again, and then he said, uh-oh, same situation, same response, I better see somebody, and he did.
Would you briefly address his repeated failure to register timely? There's definitely an issue of a pattern there. I'd like to days,
but
some of them are several months.
That's correct. There are no excuses. I don't even make light of that. However, the board has a policy of other cases. In one case, I'm going to be here on next month, in which the bar has complained because they implemented their policy and didn't find the violation of the lawyer. Basically, almost the same situation, almost the same number of times, same time late. One reason we put it in there is because we're seeing two different things from the board. And I think that's one reason the bar did two in the case that's up next month. Let's get some consistency here. He said, I'm sorry, there is no excuse, and I don't make any for that. However, I don't think that what we're trying to do here is not to have an actual suspension. I think the board is good. And basically, on the entire record here, that would be unusually severe. And again, in fact, as the bar says, while he was preferential treatment, he sought help. That's what his lawyer referred his lawyers to do. And while I don't think it should be rewarded necessarily, it should be penalized. And I would hope that the court, if the court's going to send a message, the message is, hey, if you've got a problem, get help. It might result in grievance, it might not, whatever, but get help for yourself as a person. His marriage is stronger. He's learned an awful lot about himself. He didn't know back in 85, he didn't know in 96. And I don't think that he deserves the international suspension, so I think he's probably going to be protected. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hafer. Mr. White.
The question before the board was simply one. one of what is the appropriate sanction in this case. The facts were largely stipulated to going to the 1996 incident, which was brought Mr. Fiddler before the committee in the first place. Again, the facts are stipulated. Mr. Fiddler had shot him. He knowingly committed that. There was no excuses provided. There was no communication that it was a mistake or misunderstanding. And he knew that it was wrong. There was a stipulation that there was a violation of 11284.
That 1996 shoplifting, was that part of the board's consideration and recommended sanction?
I have to believe it was, Your Honor. I will tell you.
They say it's not before us. I don't know how it could be before us, I guess.
I think it is because, and then I will agree with you in the interest of the camera, as we saw our previous counsel, that it makes the board's decision somewhat less than crystal clear. There's no question that it was before the board. The commission is mentioned in the decision. It was mentioned in the stipulations, which are referenced in the decision. And I can only conclude that the board's decision not to specifically make findings as to that incident are because it is in the stipulations, which are in fact part of its record and its decision. I think it's clearly part of the decision because it's repeatedly referenced to, as is the investigation into that incident, which I think goes a long way to explain why the suspension was handled. And that's why I want to begin with that, because this matter was brought before our committee, and it wasn't until after Mr. Fiddler reported this, and there's a question as to why he reported it, whether or not it was voluntary or involuntary. I don't think that's necessarily material to the question I'm raising, but it was Mr. Fiddler brought this to our committee. We interviewed him on August 1st, 1996. We asked him, the question was not, have you ever been convicted? The question was, have you ever stolen anything before? Have you ever been in trouble before? And his answer was an emphatic no. Our committee then, as we always do, did an investigation, spending our time and our resources, and learned from the security officer that, in fact, he had told Mr. Fiddler on March 27, 1996, that he did have a conviction on his record. Now, Mr. Haley talks about the finding of the board being, well, Mr. Fiddler believed that he didn't have a conviction on his record. The board also states in page 3, finding number 4, Mr. Fiddler knew or should have known that the 1985 shoplifting incident was still on his record as a conviction. So that's also a finding of the board. Having that information in his possession, when he's asked on August 1st, 1996, he owed to our committee, I believe, a duty of care. And to tell the truth.
So you're basically saying that maybe we could argue that he didn't know when he was arrested, the security officer asked him, but by the time he got to your committee, he sure should have known.
Absolutely.
Or he should have said, when the officer said, you've got a conviction, he should have gone back and checked the records, find out what went wrong, find out why and where did they file the actions that they pursued. So that's where you're throwing
In terms of the sanction, counsel, that we see a lot of really very, very reprehensible behavior by lawyers, and quite often the most reprehensible is where clients are you know, really harmed in terms of the breach of your duty to act in good faith to a client, a fiduciary duty. This case is different in that it appears that this gentleman has whatever kind of problem that causes him to steal. What he hasn't done here is what we normally see as very difficult things, people stealing from their clients, people lying to their clients about their, you know, in their professional capacity as the counsel. This gentleman didn't do that. And the sanction, I'm interested in the sanction not being for the protection of the public. Does this gentleman need to be taken out of the practice for the protection of the public, or that we found that he arguably was dishonest with the panel?
I don't sit as judge I have a way of judging one versus the other. It's one versus the other. I can tell you from my own position, this person has demonstrated, in my view, the most fundamental dishonesty there is. It's just basic theft. He knows it's wrong. He's a grown adult. He didn't do it once. He did it twice. Having been convicted in 1985 of the very incredibly similar incident, to go ahead and do it again in 1996, I think is incredibly dishonest, and I think that's exactly what we're supposed to be protecting against. I think that's exactly why we have this process.
Or it could show that he has a basic mental deficiency.
It could show that he has a basic mental deficiency, and in fact, that goes again to this issue of treatment. And I will grant you that his therapist concludes, does not say that this will never happen. But the issue of therapy, I point out in his sworn statement on September 27, 1996, which is in the record, I asked Mr. Fiddler if he was going to seek treatment. His answer to me was, no, I don't think it's necessary, I feel horrible, it'll never happen again. It wasn't until the complaint was filed in this case, Mr. Fiddler retained counsel, and in fact, he went to obtain treatment. But to further answer your question, Justice, I think there are aggravating circumstances in this case which mandated suspension. First of all, you have a course of conduct that's federal law talks about. You don't just have one incident in an unblemished career. You have two incidences which are virtually identical. But we're not being caught. There would have been damage. There would have been a loss. There would have been a harm. The second thing, you know, whether or not legally he had an obligation to report the 1985 incident, we obviously believe he did. But I think it has every bit as much value to these proceedings to demonstrate the aggravating circumstances.
I assume he doesn't claim that his late payment of the lawyer registration fee six times was caused by whatever his mental condition is. There's nothing in the record to try to defend that on that basis, I assume, is there?
And again, I just want to point that out. Again, surely it's a separate violation, or at least we believe it is, but again, it's an aggravating circumstance. This individual, you know, if you fail to pay it once, it's unexcusable, but you fail to pay it twice. This individual failed to pay it six times, every single time since his first year of practice. He has failed to pay to register currently. And that indicates to me, and I think it should indicate to the court, that we have an individual here who just doesn't play by the rules, doesn't take our system seriously. Again, as far as aggravating circumstances, he did report the 85 incident. Mr. Hafley says, well, he was young, he was fresh out of school. He also was fresh out of a bar exam, which teaches us about professional responsibility. And I said that he should have been particularly sensitive at that point in his life as to the obligation to report this. He was 30 years old. There's no question he knew it was wrong.
Can you go through for me, and I'll give Mr. Hafley a chance to do it also, the sequence of events with respect to the prosecutor? It's kind of this suggestion that he wouldn't have reported it if it hadn't been the prosecutor. I guess it was the prosecutor who said, I'll report this if you don't, and I'm glad you did because I would if you had. What's the sequence of events there?
All right, I'm going to jog my memory here a little bit, but as I recall, he was being pled in the mayor's court in probably early April of 1996. The prosecutor told him, as I understand it, in the event you don't report this, I'm going to conduct my own investigation as to what I have to do. What happened, I think what the board relied on, was Mr. Fiddler waited 3 months to report. In his letter reporting it, he says, my work took me a week to write this letter. And I think the board inferred from that, and I think the board can infer from that, that Mr. Fiddler really didn't have an intent to report this, but for being prodded.
It, I don't know if the record shows this, but it would seem it's a little unusual, I guess, that in mayor's court, a lawyer would say, I'm going to report myself. But do we know what
yeah,
the
secret is? The mayor's courts in Cincinnati have lawyers assigned to them who are practicing attorneys in Cincinnati. I can't remember who the lawyer was, but it's someone who's pretty familiar with the process, a well-known lawyer in Cincinnati. So it would not be unlikely for them to be pretty familiar with the grievance process and so forth.
So it wouldn't be unlikely then that Mr. Fiddler would have just offered to the lawyer conducting mayor's court that I'm going to report myself. Is that right? Or
I don't
want you to speculate.
Yeah, I think I think we can fairly assume there is a question, but the board just has a question of credibility. They came down to the point. Again, I don't, the in my view, the aggravating circumstance here is the failure to report the 85 incident, and specifically to report it during our investigation. Here comes an individual who theoretically is throwing himself at the mercy of the Bar Association, yet when we ask him very specific questions, he's not candid, and we have to go learn that on our own. And to me, that was a big focus of the trial before the board. It's been a big focus from day one in our case, that if we're going to look at whether or not what's the appropriate sanction here, I think we have to take into consideration this gentleman's entire conduct. In my view, he has not behaved like someone who is showing true remorse for a very, very serious acts of dishonesty. It's obvious that the court is very up to speed on the case. If there are any questions that we're having, I think the suspension is warranted under power of law. There is a course of conduct here. And I think we've got very serious acts of dishonesty and aggravated
circumstances,
all of which would support the board's sanction.
And
I would request that the objections be overruled.
Thank you, Mr. Weigel. Mr.
Hagley,
you've saved about 2.5 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Course of conduct. Shoplifting in 1985, disorderly conduct, minor misdemeanor, revision in 19. Shoplifting charge in 1996. Again, I don't want to relate to the legal point, but what the code requires, at what point does one obligation to report if this is one attached? Only crimes involving moral turpitude, traffic tickets, we obligate as a crime under the code, minor traffic violations. At what point does the lawyer have to report himself, if he has to report himself? Why? It doesn't matter if he's an alcoholic or if he was just out and he has too many on one particular occasion. These are a lot of complex questions that the code doesn't address. But a course of conduct, two incidents 11 years apart, is not a course of conduct.
I obviously read your argument about the failure to register as a lawyer, that in and of itself would sort of have conflicting views on whether that's a something for which someone receives a sanction, but combined with his lack of candor, at least with the discipline process and not responding properly to have you ever stolen something or taken something, to his, he really is practicing without authority. A number of months here. He's got 4 months, 5 months, certainly the 2 or 3 day late filings are not something we'd worry much about, but he seems there's a pattern here, isn't there, of sort of disregard for the rules? I mean, everybody else pays their fee and they practice and they pay when they have to. He doesn't. And he seems to think that we ought to just overlook that. Why should we? Why shouldn't that be a part of the sanction?
That's an attitude that I think the 4 months later and the majority of the one in this case would want the court to adopt, because the board and its findings to this shows a pattern of dishonesty and evasion because he sent his payments in late. In this case, I mentioned that I'll be here next month where the relator of the Bar Association one common objection because they enforced their policy, that same little phrase, a pattern of dishonesty and evasion. The guy just might not have the money at the time. He may be able to pay it.
But is that, if he didn't have the money, it seems to me the record would indicate that. Somebody who doesn't pay six times would have some defense. I would think he would say, I didn't have the money, or I was mentally ill, or I was sick, or whatever, but is there any excuse?
No, he isn't.
Why would we think it wouldn't happen again when he did it six times?
Well, because of this process, for one thing. I'm not complaining that it's a relator put in this complaint, but the board is adopting or applying a policy haphazardly, depending on whether they like the individual lawyer or not.
I guess I'd have to argue with it, but he appears to be a bit haphazard. That's the problem, that he appears to be. Number one, he's not honest with investigators, and then he's not honest with the court in complying with a rule that everyone else complies with, why don't we conclude that there is a pattern here of someone who maybe needs to sit out for a while? Think about, you know, what it means to be a lawyer to go by the rules. Is that, I mean...
I would hope that the court would not combine late and some. That's what it is. It's late. It's not monitoring. It's not a case where the lawyer didn't pay one for 3 years or something like that. And sole practitioners, sometimes they have problems with paying bills. And they say, well, let's put this in and this is that. Anyway, as of February 15th, my total income this year was $2,450 with a decimal of $24.50 or something. We have these problems sometimes. I mean, a sole practitioner has these 80 periods of peace and famine. And I don't want to say that happened six times straight, obviously, not to be stretching. But this is sometimes the reason why payments are substantially late, not the money in the account at the time. With respect to not being totally candid with the bar investigators, he should have been candid. But and I think the record shows the emotional turmoil he was going through, the uncertainty about, I think it's been expunged. Do I have to admit this to them? And remember, the board now is finding the fact that he was not obligated to keep the lead. He was not obliged to report or admit it. At the point he learned, some point he learned an injustice question about whether he should have checked after the security guard was against him. And he might have learned that it still might not have told him anything as far as checking with the state records and delaying it before. You can get an expungement, and sometimes you have to take a quarter of the BCI and pound on their door before they'll put it in.
You've used your time to pay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.